Welcome to Season 3 of Instant Coffee. I'm Nadine Al-Manasfi.
And I'm Sima Shihab.
And this latest season is an exploration of technology and its developments in the region.
Beyond the emergence of ChatGPT and Sophia the Robot, we wanted to speak with people who are applying, adapting, and reimagining technology in their fields.
We will be exposed to medieval Islamic hospitals, failed Gulf techno cities, emerging Iraqi fintech startups, inclusive artificial intelligence, and much more.
In this episode, Nadine speaks to Dubai-based writer, editor, and art critic Rahal Aima about what it was like growing up and now moving back to the Gulf as it becomes a region of the future. The conversation focuses on a concept she has been thinking about for some time, the Khaliji ideology, and how these ideas of future technology, nation, and identity come together. One major example of these intersections is the urban development projects we are seeing emerge in the region, which Rahal and our other guest, our very own Professor Michael Mason, director of the LSE Middle East Center, discuss in this episode. Rahal's writing spans an impressive range of themes, blending together art commentary and criticism, and social and cultural analysis, with her eyes firmly focused on where technology intersects.
Hi, Rahal. So let's start with the reason why we approached you to talk on Instant Coffee, and it was a recent article that you wrote on a phenomenon that you've coined, the Khaliji ideology. Obviously, the point of this conversation is not to rehash the article, and we do encourage those who are listening to read the full piece, which we will link to. But to start off, I just wanted to say that it is a really fascinating read that really tries to make sense of how the Gulf as a region is perceived as a place of the future. When did you start thinking about the place that you grew up in this way? And where did your thinking around the Khaliji ideology start? Was there a specific event or a trigger for you to think that this new kind of analysis of the contemporary Gulf needed to take place?
So I did grow up in Dubai. I lived in the US for a while and returned more recently. But this particular piece is kind of the product of a good, probably at least 10 years of thinking about this idea. And there's just kind of noticing that the future here and in the broader Gulf region is very much, there's no individual future, right? So you had this idea, again, kind of harking back to the US or a certain conception of what a techtopia looks like, you know, technology can save the world. And you have this idea that came out of the 90s of the California ideology, which is very much about individual liberation through technology. And the thing that always struck me here, and this is something that especially kind of picked up steam, I would say in the 2010s, is that the future is inextricable from government here. It's collective, but it's also really hand in hand. There's no opposition to government. There was a really big push around that time as well for things like smart government, for everything to be centralized and technology, not even as a mediator, but as really the link between people and between people and the state. So I think that's what really got me thinking about what does it mean, a future, you know, because you tend to think of a future as an individual liberatory thing, but as a future that is kind of hand in hand with and defined by the government. The way I think about it, this is an interesting region in that the past is something that's always contingent depending on the kind of framing and national narrative at the time. You know, I feel like when I was growing up, it was a kind of 0 to 100 narrative. First, there was nothing, and then there was oil, and then there was Dubai and or the rest of the UAE. And that narrative has changed more recently to think about, actually, this was around for, you might very see it, this place has been around or continuously inhabited at a very small scale for 10, 15,000 years. I think is one of the first places that were inhabited after the kind of human migration out of Africa. And then you kind of have now more of an emphasis about at least the last few hundred years that the current ruling family has been in power. So the past is something that's constantly changing, and the present, if that's something you inhabit. I think what's interesting about this region is the future is the only thing that's certain, which kind of goes against, in a way, the way you might think of the future as a question mark elsewhere.
This is a really interesting way of thinking about this vision of the future that's coming out of the Gulf. How do you see its real-life manifestations?
So I think this is something that's happened at several levels. I think the first level is aesthetic, and I would say it's an aesthetic that is very much informed by a kind of 1960s Western conception of the space age, but a ready association with the new cities. By new, I mean they've been around for some time, but have kind of exploded in growth in the post-oil period. So a kind of ready association for people around the world, and an association which has become congealed into city and national brands is, you know, these cities are futuristic. They're silver and shiny, and, you know, they perhaps resemble, because of the desert next to them, they resemble a lunar or a Martian kind of landscape. I don't know how much of this was actively constructed, but it's something that's happened, and I think these cities have really run with it. If you don't necessarily have a claim to the past, which is the case for very many cities here, you can absolutely have a claim to the future. So I think that's one part of it, is on an aesthetic level. Another one is that, you know, all of these cities, or many of these cities, I'm wary of talking about a lot of places at the same time, are trying very hard to organize or to reorganize themselves for a post-oil future and what that would look like. And with that comes a very heavy emphasis on technology. I think it's, again, it's like, what are the arenas that you as a city, as a country, can compete in? Technological development and having, most crucially, the resources to fund that development, I think, is a big thing. And I would also say a third thing is some of these cities or city-states, and I say city-states in the sense that they might be part of looser federations, as is the case in the UAE, until more recently have functioned relatively autonomously, although that's changing now in recent years, with kind of the push from Abu Dhabi in the UAE. But most of these cities are futuristic on a demographic and a legal and a socio-political level, not necessarily because of what they look like, but you have these cities that have more in common with other kind of major metropoles around the world than they might necessarily have with the city that's, you know, 100 kilometers away in the same country. So part of this is kind of new forms of citizenship, new forms of belonging or not belonging. I wouldn't say a dissolution, but just kind of a reframing of what the nation state and the relationship between the population and the nation state looks like if you don't necessarily inherit or choose to inherit some of the older forms of relationships between the person and the state.
And one major way that Gulf states are exploring the future is through these large-scale urban development projects and tying them to progressive environmental initiatives. What do you make of these?
For NEOM and Saudi Arabia, it goes as far as, I believe the way they framed it in the recent Venice Architecture Biennial was zero gravity, but kind of zero footprint, zero everything. And you have these things which are about, we're going to revolutionize the way of living in this century, in the centuries to come, with the assumption that these places might be around in centuries to come. But really, they are about maintaining very much a present. I think one of the big pushes is clean energy. So I think there's a plan to have something like 75% of all energy to be clean energy by 2050. I think it's another kind of maintenance of the present, right? If the UAE right now is among the countries that are the biggest energy providers, there's an aim to have that kind of seamlessly transitioning to still be being the biggest energy providers. I think you're seeing this on a global level with energy countries are like, we used to do hydrocarbons, now we're going to do clean or green, however realistic those are, we're going to do these different kinds of energy, and it's still going to be us playing the same role into the foreseeable future. So I think the usage of clean energy, cleaner energy, because I don't think there's necessarily such a thing as clean energy. I think that's another thing that they're working on. I don't know how successful there is. I know they're making efforts to preserve water resources and looking at ways to reverse desertification. And I think one of the more interesting things they're working on is biosaline agriculture, which is using slightly salty water. Because right now we're in a situation where actually long ago, all the groundwater is pretty much tapped out. All the water that we use, or almost all the water that we use, I don't know the exact percentage, is desalinated from the sea, which is incredibly expensive and resource intensive. Technology is really used to kind of, I wouldn't even say necessarily maintain the status quo, but maintain the current systems for as long as possible. I think there's language of environmentalism brought in. It is on an optical level talking about change, but really it's about just maintaining the current situation and the current levels of comfort for as long as possible, as opposed to make dramatic changes.
I mean, these initiatives are all state-led, right? I guess I'm thinking now about grassroots initiatives who want to utilize technology for environmental good. I guess perhaps sometimes big changes might want to be achieved. Where do these communities or interest groups fit?
My sense is that there isn't such a differentiation. Maybe sometimes it's about access to resources or about a willingness on the state level to do as much as it can. How successfully, I don't know. But my sense of everything that's happening is that really it does happen at a state level. It begins with kind of these future casted plans, you know, the plan for the X year vision, for the green plan, for clean energy. I guess it does look like that things, a plan is made and then steps are made to implement it at all levels of society, either through legal means, you know, new buildings must be built in this and this way. And what works here is that there's the possibility of absolute enforcement, you know. If they say, let's say all new buildings should run entirely on renewable energy by this year, that is something that will happen. There isn't the option of it, you know, not happening. Really, it does seem like things are very much directed in that way. If you wanted to do something on a grassroots level, the question would be why, when if your end goal is to effect some kind of environmental change, it works better or would be more successful kind of working with whatever authority. Because I think this is a place where, at least right now, environmental change is very much in the goals of the country. So it's not something that, you know, you're working against big business because the government is kind of on board. This is everyone in this. And this is how things work in general. I think everyone is kind of on board.
While Rahel has presented a fascinating picture of how she understands future making in the Gulf, we wanted to understand the intricacies of some of the specific mega projects taking place now. We asked Michael Mason, director of the LSE Middle East Center and professor of environmental geography at the LSE, about some of these high-tech urban development projects and how he understands their position in the built environment and politics of the region.
When we look at the high-profile urban development projects in the region, I think one thing that strikes you, at least me, as an observer, is their radical disconnection from their surrounding landscape. So we're thinking about things like NEOM, the mega project, mega urban project in Saudi Arabia, Masdar City in Abu Dhabi, or New Cairo in Egypt. And we see they have differences in scale, difference in technologies, but I think we can collectively see them as spectacles of high technology infrastructure which construct their own physical environment. In doing so, I think they represent a type of urban development which some have described as terraforming, in which you create your own kind of physical urban environment. Now, on the one hand, this might seem to be a good thing insofar as these projects embrace environmentalism. So we see, at least in terms of the projects in Saudi Arabia and in Abu Dhabi, quite ambitious plans to embrace renewable energy, car-free walkable neighborhoods, zero waste desalination, housing for rapidly expanding population. So you then avoid urban sprawl. So this is all good stuff. And even though in practice, if we look at Masdar City in Abu Dhabi, some of the green ambitions of this urban experiment to be the world's most sustainable eco-city were delayed and scaled back. But it still today has demonstrable technologies which demonstrate the potential for using, for example, sustainable energy, water use technologies, supporting investment in green technology companies. And also with NEOM, which is a much earlier stage, much greater scale, both Masdar and NEOM funded by sovereign wealth funds. So you need to have that massive resourcing behind you for this type of mega project. And these are drawn upon so-called smart city ideas from other countries, including in Europe, for example, Oslo in Norway and Amsterdam, with the idea of floating villages, for example, in Amsterdam, electric vehicle use in Oslo. So there is this sort of sharing, if you like, of perceived best practice in greening urban development. But the scale, at least in terms of NEOM, is far greater than anything else in terms of green urban development elsewhere in the world. And that's of interest in terms of the ambition and the scale. At the same time, these are systems, at least in terms of the plans for NEOM, which are high surveillance systems, tracking individuals through their individual lives in terms of energy use, their mobility, what they're doing 24 hours a day. So these are highly controlled, technologically driven urban models. And for me, at least, what they seem to miss is what I would call the kind of soft city attributes of urban living, of individuals and communities, how they experience the urban environment in often a quite an organic or contingent or accidental way. So I think there's a livability deficit, I would call it, of some of these grand green mega projects, because they don't seem to factor in the extent to which in urban environments, I think livability is being open to and experiencing and value some of the unexpected, you know, manifestations of the urban environment, including, for example, the natural world. So that, I think that's a big challenge when you've got these ultra high-tech, technologically determined models of urban development.
Michael also responded to a very broad and probably unfair question we put to him. Considering the pressing challenges in the region that also reverberate globally, such as the devastating effects of climate crisis, are smart cities the answer?
I mean, this is a big question, of course. I think generally we can say that innovative technologies are certainly a valuable, sometimes necessary tool in addressing pressing environmental problems. There are lots of examples of where they work well, but that technology alone is not sufficient. But environmental technologies can be developed or adapted in situations in which human freedoms may not be respected or fostered. For example, if we think about the NEOM development, it's been reported that about 50 tribes people have been jailed for opposing eviction to make way for work on NEOM. Some of these tribes people receive very large prison sentences. At least three that I know of have been sentenced to death simply for saying, I'd rather not move, thank you very much. Was saying the compensation you're offering is not sufficient. So there's a glaring contradiction there between the kind of utopian pretensions to livability of NEOM. Look at us, this is a great grand green vision of future urban living. And then as soon as you encounter a real world need to negotiate with a community negatively affected by this, you do so in a very authoritarian way. And I think that's an alarm, you know, in terms of something that should warn us to be careful about how we perceive and understand some of these sort of mega urban projects. If we think about technology, the application of knowledge to deliver practical goals which are contribute to human welfare and well-being, and how we innovate, how we use technology is always embedded in wide understandings of how we want to live, how we relate to each other, what kind of society we want to be in, how we deal with each other in terms of politics. So, you know, if we want to think about green technology in terms of living within a free society, then the technological choices we make must be part of, at least for me, open and inclusive political choices. Because if you don't have that buy-in from people, if they don't regard themselves as having a real meaningful stake in the choices being made, then you're left with something which is simply a green ideology masking authoritarian rule.
Rahel spoke of a similar question that those who decide to move to the Gulf weigh up and the kind of trade-offs that take place.
One thing here is a very kind of centralized network, again, mediated or not mediated through technology. For some people, the trade-off of this is a lack of privacy or of privacy from, let's say, the government. I think when you live here, you assume that everything that is said or written is heard or read, just kind of as a very basic baseline. I think this changes the way you interact with technology or the expectations that you have. I remember when I was living in the US and I think came out that Russia had meddled in their elections, as the US has tended to do in most people's elections kind of around the world. And I remember like a lot of my American friends or like American society as a whole was actually like shocked. And their shock was kind of shocking to me, or just kind of something like, you know, WikiLeaks, like a shock that the governments are doing this kind of thing. I think considering a place futuristic and like this is the way the world is going, I think the Gulf tends to be flashier. I think what you see here is a kind of early indicator of things that are happening elsewhere in the world, just maybe more openly or more easily perceivable. Like what happens here will happen elsewhere, is happening elsewhere, just at a kind of slower pace. For that reason, this is one of the most interesting regions, to me, the most interesting region in the world. It's not unique as people would like to see it.
And speaking about external perceptions of the Gulf, of the UAE, to what extent do you think that they are two-dimensional?
I think they exist, and I think they will always continue to exist. I think the counter to that is a different kind of knowledge production, you know, on an academic level. This is happening a little bit on an artistic level, but when you have people parachuting in, and this is something I think about a lot as a writer who sometimes goes, increasingly does so, but often goes on kind of press trips, like how do you write about a place that you don't know? So I think what will be more interesting is when this kind of knowledge production shifts and the place is written about, which you see a little bit, or, you know, depicted through film, through any media, by people who have a more robust understanding of the place or just a different experience of the place, because there's no one kind of experience. I think there can also be a tendency to be like, you know, Dubai is not flashy. This is not the real Dubai. There is this organic, this kind of thing. And I think that is equally as one-dimensional. You know, people are like, look, here's pedestrian life with a kind of beeline to particularly South Asian or working class areas as a kind of black and white contrast. I think, you know, all of these things are true. I think the major thing, honestly, in the depictions of Dubai or the UAE is that this is kind of, I think of it as a kind of warehouse, you know. I don't know how this maps anymore to actual GDP percentages, but this is basically, it always has been, it's a trading city. You know, what you see kind of above the surface in tourism, the finance, all of these things, fiercely working below the surface of the water is just a bunch. This is a city of warehouses that moves goods, that moves people, sometimes moves ideas. But this is really, you know, and one thing that's been interesting is the way this region, Qatar and the UAE, have over a few decades reoriented the global trade routes. But like, if you want to cross the world, very often you're going to go through this region. That is, I think that's something that contributes a huge amount to the economy. And that is really, this is a warehouse city.
And to wrap up, I'd like to come back to aesthetics and art a bit, which is what you write and think about the most. How does the Khaliji ideology compare to previous or maybe still ongoing trends and ways of thinking about the Gulf? I'm specifically thinking about the Gulf Futurism label that was quite prominent in the art scene.
So I think Gulf Futurism in retrospect is a useful way of thinking. So when we say Gulf Futurism, we're talking about a kind of aesthetic movement, and the term was coined by artist and filmmaker Sophia Almaria, who's a Qatari American, around the late 2000s, early 2010s, around this time. I think there was kind of a realization, the same association of Gulf and future, shiny space age, neoprene fabrics, a certain set of aesthetic touch zones, I think is what became understood as Gulf Futurism. There was, I also think of Gulf Futurism as very much post-Gulf War, the 1990 Gulf War, and kind of almost a congealing of this nervous energy of that particular time, a kind of friction or tension, a wariness, a kind of crackle. And I think Gulf Futurism, in retrospect, people were not necessarily making work in that vein for that much longer. I would be curious what Sophia, you know, thinks about it. I think it's very much of that time. And what you see with the Khaliji ideology, firstly, is a zooming out of scale. You're not looking at an individual, and an individual often racialized, ethnicized figure. Gulf Futurism features a certain kind of body and a certain kind of person and a certain kind of individual figure. And you're not seeing that with Khaliji ideology. This is a time for various economic, perhaps, reasons, which I think will look like the introduction of income tax in, if not in 1 or 2 years, in very soon. You had, along with this, you know, future thing, you had this association of, not even association, it was a reason why a lot of people go to the Gulf, is promise of tax-free income. But kind of what you are seeing, beginning with the UAE, and I don't know if this will change elsewhere, you have two forces, right, happening in the Gulf right now. One is kind of nationalization of the workforce, or moving of the workforce into the private sphere. In the UAE, it's called emiratization. In Oman, Omanization, Saudization. And at the same time, you also have in somewhere like the UAE is the introduction of green and golden visas, which are something analogous to permanent residencies, but not quite, in that they don't necessarily come with the set of rights that a permanent residency might, but also with the understanding that people in these residencies do not necessarily want a full set of rights. Or if one right that you don't have, for example, is the right to vote at the lower levels here, or some people might come from countries where voting is not something they particularly believe in or engage in, or the more important thing is to have a stable life and access to a certain standard of living, which might not be possible, whether because of war or other instability or just the economic situation in their own countries, and people are happy to have a new kind of residency, which is not quite permanent residency, which is not a path to citizenship, but are very, very happy to have this and this kind of sense of stability in their lives. And the sense is that this is moving towards the changing the relationship of the person, the non-citizen resident, to the state, I think, is an economic need, and moving towards a kind of a further changing of this concept of the Gulf as this tax-free haven, a place you go to make money and then leave, and the money leaves too. All of which is to say, so I feel like this is a very long detour, but you have two currents, right? One is of the citizen, a kind of semi-national impetus, and at the same time talking about our country, all of us, and a kind of expanded we, which might not be the we might not include the same people in 5 years. That's also possible as priorities and government visions change, but at least from what you're seeing with Khaliji ideology, I think it is at this moment a lot more inclusive, which is something that differentiates it very much from Gulf futurism.
So that's actually all we have time for, but thank you so much for speaking to us, Rahel. It was really interesting to hear more about the Khaliji ideology, a frame of thinking about the Gulf that I'm sure we will all now be considering a lot more as we interact with the Gulf in our research and as we read about it in the news. It was really great to hear more about how you understand life in the region as someone who has grown up and watched its staggering transformations and experimentations. So thanks once again.
Thank you for listening to Instant Coffee, a podcast brought to you by the LSE Middle East Center. Join us every other Tuesday for a new episode. And don't forget to follow us on your favorite streaming platforms.